had indicated that we would probably go 5 hours today, which would take us to approximately 6 o'clock. But I think we would certainly go for at least another hour or so, perhaps not quite all the way to 6 o'clock. But we'll talk to each other and look for a signal from the Chief Justice about exactly when we would end the day for six. At this point, Mr. Chief Justice, I believe that we're ready for the next question. I believe the previous question came from Senator Lieberman, and therefore I send the next question to the desk.
This question is from Senators Thompson and Snow to the House managers. Do the managers wish to respond to the answer given by the President's counsel with regard to the poll taken by Dick Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Just before we recessed, there was a question directed to the President's defense attorneys regarding the Dick Morris poll, and one of the responses to it was that it was basically irrelevant. I think it's one of the more important things that has occurred in this case because we get a look inside that window that's blocked for the most part throughout these proceedings. We really get an eye into the minds that are working here. Not only does it say volumes about a person who has to take a poll to decide whether or not to tell the truth, it also provides a great deal of information toward the actual state of mind, the actual willfulness, the actual intent of the actor, in this case, who has had the poll taken. Let me just read briefly from the referral regarding this incident, and it talks about how Mr. Morris tells the President that this country has a great capacity for forgiveness and we should consider tapping into it. And the President responds, well, what about that legal thing, Starr and the perjury and all? And they go on to have a discussion and decide to take a poll that night. Now, this is January the 21st, and in all fairness to the President, it's not clear from the record that I have and that he had had a conversation with Sidney Blumenthal and John Podesta that day before this effort. The poll was taken and the results reported that same day, late that evening, or whether the conversation with Mr. Podesta and Mr. Blumenthal occurred afterwards. And those were the ones, in essence, where he questioned what went on, and also with Mr. Blumenthal fairly well attempted to discredit Ms. Lewinsky, too. And you'll see how that may or may not tie in, again, depending on the chronology, but certainly all those events happened the same day. Mr. Morris takes the poll and reports later that evening, same evening, the 21st, the results of that, and it basically says the voters are willing to forgive the President for adultery, but not for the perjury or the obstruction of justice. And then, according to Mr. Morris, the President answers, well, we'll just have to win then. And later, the next day, the President has a follow-up conversation with Mr. Morris during the evening and says that he is considering holding a press conference to blast Monica Lewinsky out of the water. But Mr. Morris urges caution. He says, be careful. According to Mr. Morris, he warned the President not to be too hard on Ms. Lewinsky because there's some slight chance that she may not be cooperating with Starr, and we don't want to alienate her by anything we're going to put out. That is chilling. It truly is chilling that our chief law enforcement officer, the person who sends our soldiers off as commander-in-chief to possibly die, the person who appoints federal judges, Supreme Court justice, nominates Supreme Court justices, appoints U.S. attorneys around the country who try 50,000 cases a year, has that mentality, and it goes to the state of mind here. And the willfulness and the intentions from that point forward certainly are reflected in the perjury and the efforts to continue the obstruction, the pattern, the overall pattern, not just one little incident. And I urge you, Senators, as you consider this, to consider it carefully. And as I said in my opening remarks, don't isolate little facts here and there and take the spins, but in every alleged act, ask yourself the two questions, whether it's the hiding of the gifts, the filing of the false affidavit, letting Bob Bennett use that false affidavit while sitting still, talking to Sidney Blumenthal and John Podesta about what did not really happen, the job search. Ask on every one of those, what was the result? What was the result of those actions? Now, I think in every case you'll see that something occurs to block the Paula Jones case, the discovery of evidence, the receipt of truthful testimony. And ask yourself the second question, who benefits from that? And I'll guarantee you every time, in every one of those instances, it's the president that benefits, that derives the effect of that. And he is either the most luckiest man in the world because of this and having people willing to commit crimes for him, or he is somewhere in the background orchestrating this.
This is from Senators Lay, Harkin, Dorgan, and Reed of Nevada to the President's Counsel. In his opening remarks to the Senate, Manager McCollum stated, "I don't know what the witnesses will say, but I assume if they are consistent, they'll say the same thing that's in here," referring to the 60,000-page record currently before the Senate. "I see no reason to call witnesses to provide redundant testimony." Could you comment on Mr. McCollum's statement and clarify also the timetable which might have to be considered for discovery if witnesses are called?
Mr. Chief Justice, I think, as I said in an earlier question, that the answers the witnesses would provide are already contained in the five volumes of testimony. As I'm sure you're aware, when I say five volumes, that's not really five volumes, because on many of the pages, the grand jury transcript are shrunk. It's called miniscript. So you get six pages of testimony per page. Your eyesight may fail you before you get through. The witness testimony is there. I don't think calling the witnesses again will add anything to that. In terms of a discovery schedule, it's hard to say, because we have had no opportunity to shape the record. We don't know what we'll need. We would need documents. We would need testimony. One deposition could lead to another. I think we are talking a matter of a few months to finally get through it. But I think the real question is, what questions are there that have not been asked? I think if you ask that question, what questions are there that haven't been asked, you'll find there are no questions there. In fact, the questions have been asked a number of times. Now, Mr. Manager Hutchison told you that, well, the independent counsel didn't have a chance to ask questions after the president's testimony. Indeed, he did. You'll see that Ms. Lewinsky's was examined after the president testified, both in the grand jury and in FBI interviews. I don't think that witness interviews or further evidentiary proceedings will add in any measurable way to the record before you.
Question is directed to the House managers by Senators Hatch, Thompson, DeWine, and Warner. The unanimous consent agreement pending before the Senate permits the filing of a motion to dismiss next week. What legal standard should the Senate apply? And applying that standard to this case, what specific acts of presidential misconduct would a senator deem unworthy of impeachment by voting for a motion to dismiss?
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Senate, the President wants all of the protections of a criminal trial, beyond a reasonable doubt, standard of proof, strict pleadings, but yet deny us the right to call any witnesses. You know, in the House, we did not call witnesses, and there's a reason. There's several reasons for that. First of all, we were operating under time constraints, which were self-imposed, but I promised my colleagues to finish it before the end of the year. I didn't want it to drag out. We had an election intervene, we had Christmas, but we did, because we had 60,000 pages of sworn testimony, transcripts, depositions, grand jury testimony, and we had a lower threshold. The threshold in the House was for impeachment, which is to seek a trial in the Senate. We could not try the case in the House. The Constitution gives the Senate the exclusive right to try the case. All we could do was present evidence sufficient to convince our colleagues that there ought to be a trial over here in the Senate. And we did that. But now that we're over here, and by the way, we were roundly criticized for not producing any witnesses, and I might add, Mr. Kendall has said repeatedly they did not have a fair discovery process. They didn't have any witnesses and weren't permitted to cross-examine. I want to tell you repeatedly, I invited the president's lawyers, the staff of the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee, any witnesses you want, call them, give me their names, and we'll bring them in. And you can cross-examine them to your heart's content. No, they never did. Finally, they brought in some professors, and Mr. Ruff testified, Mr. Craig testified, but they didn't want any fact witnesses. That's the last thing they wanted. They had full opportunity to call them, and I really, really bristle when they say you were unfair. We wanted to be fair. We tried to be fair because we understand you need a two-thirds vote to remove the president. We needed Democratic support. So far, we have none. That's okay. Let the process play itself out. But we were fair. And when Mr. Kendall says they had no opportunity, he means they didn't avail themselves of an abundant opportunity to call witnesses. Now, a motion in lieu of a trial should provide that all inferences, all fact questions, be resolved in favor of the respondent, the House managers. I don't think that's going to happen. I think by dismissing the articles of impeachment before you have a complete trial, you are sending a terrible message to the people of the country. You're saying, I guess, perjury is okay if it's about sex, obstruction is okay, even though it is an effort to deny a citizen her right to a fair trial. You're going to say that even when judges have been impeached for perjury. And by the way, the differing standards between judges and the president, this country can survive with a few bad judges, a few corrupt judges. We can make it. But a corrupt president, survival is a little tougher there. So there is a difference, and the standard ought to be better, more sensitive for the president, because the president is such an important person. Look, the consequences of cavalier treatment of our articles of impeachment, your articles of impeachment, you throw out the window the fact that the president's lies and stonewalling have cost millions of dollars that could have been obviated. The damage to sexual harassment laws, you think they're not going to be damaged? They are. Seriously. Making it more difficult to prosecute people in the military or elsewhere for perjury who lie under oath. Those are serious consequences. I know, oh do I know, what an annoyance we are in the bosom of this great body. But we're a constitutional annoyance. And I remind you of that fact. Thank you.
This question is from Senator Durbin to counsel for the president. Can you comment on Manager Hyde's contention that the president was free to call witnesses before the House excuse me, but that the House did not have the time to do so or to call any witnesses.
Mr. Chief Justice, I think it's important to understand the reality of what was going on in the House. Most of you know something of it by simply a virtue of press coverage, but let me tell you what it was like from the perspective of the President. From the very first moment in which we began to speak with representatives of the Judiciary Committee, whether senior staff or the chairman, who was always gracious to us, the one thing we said was, please tell us what we're charged with, please. And we went from Mr. Schiffer's extensive opening discussion of 15 possible violations of law to an ever-shifting body. And it wasn't until I was within literally a few minutes of completing my testimony on December 9th that we were ever honored with anything that looked like a description of the violations that the President was charged with, and those came in the form of our draft articles of impeachment. Indeed, if you'll all remember back, if any of you were watching that day, I was actually given a draft copy of those articles just as I was completing my testimony, and then they were snatched back because it was premature for the President's counsel at 4:30 in the afternoon on December 9th to know what the President was charged with. Now, one thing you generally like to know as a litigator in any form, before you start thinking about producing exculpatory evidence as we were asked to do, or thinking about calling witnesses, is to sort of know what you have to defend against. In any forum, whether it's criminal or civil or legislative, the accused generally has that right. Now, beyond that, as you all know, and indeed as Mr. Manager Hyde has indicated, we were operating on a very fast track. We asked, for example, when the issue arose, as to whether or not the staff of the committee would take depositions, whether we would be entitled to be present, because we knew that none of them were on the calendar to be called in any open hearing, and we were denied that opportunity, theoretically because under the policies of the committee, it was not appropriate for the President's counsel to be present at the only opportunity that certain witnesses would ever have to testify under oath. It seems odd to me, when you come right down to it, that we should be accused of failing in our duty with the burden on the House Judiciary Committee to make its case and our right to respond meaningfully, that the House, having determined never to call a witness who knew anything firsthand, we should somehow be charged with having fit in to this discovery process. Discovery is very different, as all of you understand, from calling a witness, whoever it may be, in public before the full Judiciary Committee and having the opportunity to examine them. We were excluded from whatever true discovery process might have been involved, and left only with this notion that in the absence of any specific charges, we were to call witnesses to defend ourselves. I suggest to you that in any setting that we are used to, whether those of you who are litigators or those of you who are simple observers of the justice system, that's a very odd process indeed.
This question is from Senator Nichols to the House managers. Which of the President's statements not already discussed today do you believe to be of particular importance to the perjury charge?
Mr. Chief Justice,
I thank the senators for the question. I will keep one eye on the clock and stay within the five-minute rule, so obviously I won't be able to give, again, a comprehensive list of that which we submit to the Senate as perjurious, but within the next few minutes, let me try to get through at least one or two of them. One example that I would invite the Senate's attention to are the answers the President gave in his grand jury about his attorney using Monica Lewinsky's false affidavit. Now, bear in mind again the predicate facts for this. Judge Susan Weber Wright in the deposition had ordered the President to answer questions relating to whether he ever had a sexual relationship with subordinate female employees in the workplace as governor or as president, because that is fair game in any sexual harassment suit. Victims of harassment in the workplace are entitled to discover that information. The President was able to get Monica Lewinsky to file a false affidavit in the Jones deposition. And when that affidavit was in hand and filed, as soon as the attorney for Paula Jones asked the first question about Monica Lewinsky, the President's attorney, Mr. Bennett, put forth that affidavit and objected to the attorney's even asking the question. He said there's no good faith belief that this question should be asked because of the affidavit. And the President did absolutely nothing to correct the record. When this came up in the grand jury, the President was asked about the affidavit and the statement that Mr. Bennett made to Judge Wright, that there was no sex of any kind in any manner, shape, or form. And the attorney, Mr. Bittman, at the grand jury referred to that and said to the President, that statement is a completely false statement, and asked the President to explain. And this was the President's answer. He said, it depends on what the meaning of the word is. If is means is and never has been, that is one thing. If it means there is none, that was a completely true statement. However, then the President went on to say, I was not paying a great deal of attention to this exchange. I was focusing on my own testimony. Now, rather than simply give a truthful and complete answer to the grand jury in their criminal investigation, the President gave a bifurcated answer that essentially invited the grand jury to accept one of two explanations. Explanation number one, I wasn't paying attention to my attorney when he said that. I was busy thinking of other things. Or, if you don't like that explanation, I was paying such specific attention to what my attorney was saying that I focused on the tense of what the word is meant. As if to suggest when Mr. Bennett said there is no sex of any kind, he meant there was no sex that day because he was there being deposed before Judge Wright. Under either scenario, the President absolutely failed in his obligation to provide the grand jury conducting a criminal investigation into possible obstruction in the Paula Jones case. He failed in his obligation to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And you've seen the evidence just from the initial presentations. Number one, when the President said he wasn't paying attention, that was negated by watching the videotape. The President was paying very close attention. And why was he paying such close attention? Because the fate of his presidency hung on the answer to that question. This is the most important question in the President's political life. Is he going to have to disclose information that he thought would help destroy his presidency? You don't even have to accept the representation from the videotape to know the President testified falsely, because Mr. Bennett did us the favor of not asking us simply to rely on watching the President pay attention to the testimony. Mr. Bennett then read the President the portion of Ms. Lewinsky's affidavit in which she denied having a sexual relationship with the President, and he asked the President if Ms. Lewinsky's statement was true and accurate, and here's what the President said. That is absolutely true. Now, on August 6th, Monica Lewinsky, incidentally, testified before the grand jury, and she didn't play these games with the grand jury. It all depends what is means, or I wasn't paying attention. She was asked a straightforward question, just as the President was. The question to Monica Lewinsky was, paragraph 8 of the affidavit says, I have never had a sexual relationship with the President. Is that true? Answer by Monica Lewinsky, no. Mr. Chief.
Chief Justice, I see my time has expired. I would be happy to invite additional questions relating to additional specific examples.
This is to the President's Counsel from Senators Schumer and Kerry of Nebraska. Isn't it true that the alleged perjurious statements have changed in number and substance since the OIC first delivered its referral to the House, and that the referral, Mr. Schiffer's presentation before the House, the majority report, the trial brief, and the manager's statements before this body contain different allegations of what constitutes the alleged perjurious statements?
Mr. Chief Justice, the answer to that question is yes, and they were changing right up until the time we met, the very first day of this trial, and Mr. Manager Rogan made his presentation. What he said when he described perjurious statements alleged against the President was different from what was appearing in the trial brief before. And that was the end of a long period of time where every time we heard what the allegations were, at least when it came to the issue of perjury, they changed. There were allegations added, there were allegations subtracted. Two of the allegations that Mr. Schippers presented when he made his statement to the Judiciary Committee were withdrawn. So it was a process that we never had a chance to sit down, as you should in a very serious and fair and even-handed exercise, focus on what precisely it was that the President said in the grand jury that was perjurious. Now, as to the specifics of the allegation that we've been discussing just now. When Mr. Rogan, when I first opened this discussion, I said it's very important to look at the record. Do not allow anyone to misrepresent the record, because you're setting up the President's statement and saying that's perjurious, when the President's statement may well be something very different in the record. Now, Mr. Rogan, when he first made his argument on this issue, misrepresented the record as to what the President said on this case. I tried to correct him about what the President actually said. He never claimed that at the moment these questions were being asked back and forth that he thought about the current tense. And even as I was speaking, Mr. Rogan was out talking to the television camera saying precisely the same thing. Now we have the same misrepresentation the third time. I'll say it one more time. He answered the question. He wasn't focusing on it. He answered that four times the same way. It was not a bifurcated answer. It was one answer. He was not paying attention at that particular moment. It moved very quickly. The moment was passed, and they were into the judge talking and debating with the lawyers. That was his answer. There was no other answer. Then at the grand jury, some 7 months later, he was read that statement by the special prosecutor, and his answer was, as the question was, and this statement was false. Isn't that true? And the answer that the President gave was, well, in fact, depends on the meaning of the word is. What is the meaning of is? And he didn't claim that that was what he was thinking at the time in the Jones deposition. He said very clearly, I never even focused on that issue until I read it in this transcript in preparation for this testimony. It's on page 512, Mr. Rogan. I never even focused on that until I read it in this transcript in preparation for this testimony. There was not a bifurcated answer. He answered directly. He wasn't focusing on it. Now, that is a problem we have had throughout this case when it comes to the perjury allegations. It was a problem we had with the earlier one. If you don't have the specific statement quoted, it's impossible to defend it. It's unfair. Thank you very much.
This question is from Senator Lott to the House managers. Do you wish to respond to the answer just given by the President's counsel?
Mr. Chief Justice, I'm not sure if it's I wish to respond or I feel the need to respond, but in either event, I will take advantage of the opportunity, and I thank the Senator for posing the question. Try as they might, the facts are clear. The President, in his August deposition, attempted to justify away, attempted to explain away his perjurious conduct on January the 17th when he was deposed. And I'm not going to stand and quibble with Mr. Craig over this beyond what we've already noted. What I prefer to respond to is the bigger question that the White House attorneys have raised on a number of occasions. The idea that the president has been treated unfairly because he hasn't had sufficient notice as to what the allegations are against him. Contemplate that for just one moment. Because for that to be true, the president of the United States would have to be not a human, he would have to be an ostrich with his neck so far down in the sand that which every school child now in America knows, that which every person in America with a television or a radio or internet access knows, and is obvious to everybody, they claim is not obvious to the president. When the president of the United States testified at the deposition and before the grand jury, that brought us into late August of 1998. About a month after that, the Office of Independent Counsel filed a report. The binder was about 445 pages. The written document is a little more than 200 pages. But within the four corners of that report are all of the allegations, are all of the facts, and all of the circumstances that were forwarded to the House of Representatives for review. The House Judiciary Committee specifically, at the request of the White House and at the request of our Democrat colleagues, did not go beyond the four corners of Judge Starr's report. Not only did the president have the benefit of Judge Starr's report, he also had the benefit of the written report from the House Judiciary Committee. Same facts, same circumstances, nothing changed. And by the time we came here to the Senate to try this case, the president had the benefit of the resolution passed by this body that said in the initial presentations, we will not go beyond the record already established. The record that was established in the Office of Independent Counsel report, in the committee's report, and in our hearings. And for a party to be so aggrieved, as the White House counsel suggests, to have been given no notice, it's amazing to me how within minutes of Judge Starr's report being filed, they had already filed a response. And I believe there were two supplemental responses within 48 or 72 hours. They have always beaten us to the punch on the response. They have an army of lawyers here able to stand up on a moment's notice and respond. And I just don't understand how they can make the case fairly that this is all now a product of surprise, that they have not been given a proper opportunity to review the facts. They have seen these facts since Judge Starr submitted his report to Congress some 5 months ago. The facts haven't changed, the circumstances haven't changed, the quotations haven't changed, the transcripts haven't changed, nothing has changed except their attempt to wiggle out from under the truth.
This question is from Senators Boxer, Schumer, and Cole to the President's counsel. To the best of your knowledge, has the United States Department of Justice ever brought a perjury prosecution where the alleged perjury was inferred from the direction in which the defendant was looking?
Chief Justice, the answer is not to my knowledge. I won't go farther than that because somebody in the army of people on the other side might dredge one up, but I doubt it very much. I think if I may impose on the kindness of the authors of that last question, I'll take just a moment to comment briefly on Mr. Manager Rogan's rejoinder to our response to whatever. I truly, particularly because Mr. Manager Rogan has been a judge and prosecutor and others have as well, it does seem mildly odd to me that the answer to the question your charges aren't known or are vague is, look at that pile, you'll find them right in there. Or, golly, you guys did a good job of responding to what you could, so you must be perfectly well prepared to defend against whatever charges we bring. I don't think there's a judge anywhere in the United States, highest court or lowest court, who would accept either explanation from a prosecutor.
This question is directed to the House managers by Senators Hatch and Burns. The president's lawyers cite in their brief Professor Michael Gerhardt for the proposition that for an act to be impeachable, there must be a nexus between the misconduct of an impeachable official and the latter's official duties. But isn't it true that Professor Gerhardt also stated that impeachment may lie for conduct unrelated to official duties if such conduct is outrageous and harms the reputation of the office, in a citation to the testimony of Mr. Gerhardt? Would the House managers care to respond to this?
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the Senate, I do appreciate the opportunity to respond to this point. I think this is a very important point. I have a great deal of respect for Professor Gerhardt, and he has said a number of different things on this subject, but the point in the question is directly on point. I would also like to quote something else that Professor Gerhardt has said that I made reference to without specifically naming him as its source in the statement which I gave to the Senate on Saturday. He said in a law review article which he wrote a few years back, there are certain statutory crimes that, if committed by public officials, reflect such lapses of judgment, such disregard for the welfare of the state, and such lack of respect for the law and the office held, that the occupants may be impeached and removed for lacking the minimal level of integrity and judgment sufficient to discharge the responsibilities of office. Now, I believe that what Professor Gerhardt makes reference to there is exactly what we have before the Senate in this case. What we have before the Senate in this case is a case where the President of the United States has engaged in a course of conduct involving violations of the criminal law. By doing so, he has evidenced a lack of respect for the law that demonstrates a lack of the minimal level of integrity that we are entitled to expect of the Chief Executive of the United States, of the person who, under our system, is given the preeminent responsibility to take care that the laws be faithfully executed.
This question is from Senator Dodd to the Counsel for the President. Given the election of a President of the United States is the most important and solemn political act in which we as citizens engage, how much weight should the Senate give to the fact that conviction and removal by the Senate of the President would undo that decision?
That question, of course, goes right to the heart of what the framers were thinking and the standard that I suggest every sensible analyst of this problem has arrived at, whether they might be called supporters or opponents of the president. There is one critical issue that everyone has to address, which is that removal means undoing the will of the people. Mr. Manager Graham acknowledged that that's what we were all about here, whether we should undo an election. But if you go back to the very basic debates of the framers in 1787, you'll recall both Mr. Manager Kennedy and I talked about the moment in time in which it was suggested by Mr. Mason that perhaps the scope of the standard for impeachment could be broadened. and the response made then, and clearly the principle underlying everything that those framers spoke about in 1787 was, we cure almost all our problems with an elected official through the electoral process. And even if you look at what President Ford had to say 29 years ago on this subject, which I also cited to you, as he spoke about the difference between judges and presidents, he said, for the Senate to remove, the House to impeach, or the Senate to remove president or the vice president, as opposed to a judge, in midterm would require proof of the most serious offenses. And we know that those most serious offenses, the only ones that the framers contemplated as a basis for overturning the will of the people, were those that, as the minority said in 1974 in its report on this subject, that were a danger to the state, a danger to the state. That's all that can justify overturning the voice of the people.
This question is from Senator Lott. It's addressed to the House managers. Didn't the framers of the Constitution understand in 1787 that the conviction and removal from office of a president would, under the system devised, reverse the result of a national election by elevating not a president's vice presidential running mate, as we would do today, but the person who had received the second highest number of electoral votes?
Mr. Chief Justice, the statement has been made with some fervor that if the president were removed upon a finding of conviction of the articles or an article of impeachment, that it would reverse a national election. I just respectfully say that's not true. The election is provided for in the Constitution, and so is impeachment. They are processes of equal constitutional validity. And should the Senate remove the president, Bob Dole will not become president, Jack Kemp will not become vice president, but Mr. Gore will move up to be president, and the same party, the same programs, I dare say, will continue. It will not reverse an election. It will fulfill a constitutional process that our founding fathers were wise enough to provide for.
Senator Edwards asks the House managers, are there any statements contained in the exhibits used during the managers' presentations or omissions from those exhibits that you believe in the interest of fairness or justice should be corrected at this time? If so, please do so now. Perhaps I should ask Senator Edwards.
Yes, yes, regarding their exhibit.
Mr. Chief Justice, I'd be happy to take advantage of the 5 minutes, but I've talked to the other managers, and we're not aware of any corrections that need to be made on any of our exhibits that we've offered to the Senate.
The chair recognized the senator from Massachusetts.
I would simply ask whether or not that answer was in fact fully responsive to the question. I believe the question also asked whether or not there were any omissions.
the parliamentarian advised me this is a non-debatable period and that the inquiry is out of order, and I so rule. This is from Senator Roberts. It's directed to the House managers. Given the fact that the White House characterizes the assistance that Monica Lewinsky received was routine, does the record reflect that any other White House interns, other than Monica Lewinsky, received the same level of job assistance from Roberta Jordan, John Podesta, Betty Curry, and then Ambassador Richardson?
If I might, as far as we know as House managers in the record, the only comments about assisting anybody else other than Monica Lewinsky of any nature were made in testimony by Vernon Jordan. He did assist other people, but I don't believe there is anything, and to the best of our knowledge or recollection, of course, we got a lot of paperwork here, that he referred to assisting another intern or anyone in a like position, and certainly there was no indication that the kind of intensity of that assistance occurred. With the kind of manner in which the proceedings it did with developing her job opportunities, that is, somebody in this direct involvement with the president, or certainly nobody with a close relationship and interest on the part of the president. There certainly was nothing in the record to show that. And that is, of course, central to this entire case as far as the job search part of this obstruction of justice issue is concerned. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice?
The chair recognizes the senator from Kansas.
I had directed that question, sir, to the White House counsel. It was my intent to direct it to the White House counsel. I do not know what the proper procedure would be at this time.
Answering the question. Is there any objection to the White House counsel answering the question at this time? If without objection, the White House counsel may answer. Yes, White House counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. This may be a moment worth noting in these proceedings because, in essence, I think we are in agreement with Mr. Manager McCollum. I would perhaps only do this, and that is to note with some greater emphasis Mr. Jordan's testimony, which we'll be glad to highlight if we have another opportunity here, that indeed he has regularly and frequently assisted young people and not so young people in finding jobs. Again, I couldn't tell you whether any of them had been an intern at any time. I would only note that, of course, Ms. Lewinsky was not an intern at the time Mr. Jordan was helping her, but rather was an employee of the Pentagon. But beyond that, and the perhaps somewhat greater emphasis on Mr. Jordan's efforts on behalf of young people in the city, I'm essentially in agreement with the manager McCollum.
This is a question from Senators Dodd and Levin to the House managers. On page 11 of House Committee Report accepting House Resolution 611, accompanying House Resolution 611, the report states that Judge Susan Weber Wright issued her order on the morning of December 11th. Will the managers now acknowledge that the report was factually incorrect, yes or no?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. If I look back at the facts of this, of course, I've explained earlier today that the action on the 11th was initiated or triggered by the witness list that came in on December 5th that the President knew about at the latest on December 6th. On the 11th, Judge Wright entered an order in that case which allowed the Jones lawyers opportunity to ask questions about prior relationships with other federal employees or state employees.
As one of the authors,
The chair recognized the senator from Connecticut.
As one of the authors of the question, a yes or no answer was requested, and I object to the answer.
The chair is not
tried to police the responsiveness of the answers to the questions, so I'm going to overrule that objection.
You know, I'm not trying to be evasive at all to the senator, but I did want to lay the groundwork for this, and also to get my thoughts so that I would be as accurate as possible. The order that Judge Wright entered was on December 11th. I do not know the precise time. I believe it was in the afternoon that it was entered, and it was followed by the telephone call with the participant. So I believe that it was entered in the afternoon of the 11th and not in the morning of the 11th. And of course, that was not in my presentation. My presentation referred to the order being entered on December 11th, and that the action on the 11th, of course, was triggered by the witness list on December 5th. I think that completely answers that question. There's some other, I'd be happy to respond to anything more specific on that issue.
This question is directed to the House managers from Senators Domenici, Frist, McCain, and Warner. What is the historical significance and legal import of taking an oath for performance in public office? What is the historical significance and legal import of taking an oath to tell the truth in a legal proceeding? Please discuss whether oath-taking in such circumstances is a public matter.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Senate, the taking of an oath is a formalization, a solemnization of truth. You call upon God to witness to the truth of what you're saying. In the long march of civilization, the oath has taken the place of trial by fire, trial by combat, trial by ordeal. It says in the most sober way, you can trust me. You can believe in me. It's verbal honesty, and our legal system depends on it. Our justice system depends on it. The oath underscores our humanity. The oath is an aspect of our sacred honor.
This is from Senator Kerry of Massachusetts to the counsel for the president. Is it fair to say that the articles and manager presentations stress the Jones perjury allegations rejected by the House because they cannot credibly on the law satisfy the elements and argue perjury in the grand jury investigation?
The Chief Justice. I'm a little bit troubled at answering that question, not because I don't feel strongly about what the answer is, but I do not want to suggest in any way that the motivation of the managers is less than professional and appropriate. But I do think that indeed they know, as they think through the proof that they have or even might ever contemplate, that the President of the United States, when he began his grand jury testimony by making the most painful admission any human being could ever make, and thereafter did his best, albeit in the face of tough and probing and repetitive questioning for 4 hours, did his best to tell the truth, that they had a very difficult, indeed virtually impossible task to persuade any dispassionate trier of fact and law that he had intentionally given false testimony. And you can see that evidenced, I think, most clearly if you look at some of the first allegations made as to what constitutes perjury, things like the use of the word words on certain occasions or occasionally to describe a battle over whether 11 or 20 or 17 does or does not fit within that description. it does seem to me fair to say that they would not be fighting those battles in this chamber if they had any real confidence in their cause on Article One, and thus they do seek, for whatever tactical or other purpose, to try to bring in those things which so many of their colleagues rejected out of hand in the House of Representatives.
This question is directed to the House managers from Senators Hatch, Thompson, and DeWine. In her presentation to the Senate, Ms. Mills emphasized that Ms. Lewinsky testified on 10 different times about the subject of gifts. Did she ever testify that the President told her that she must turn over the gifts because that is what the law requires?
Mr. Chief Justice, in response to that question, the answer is no, she did not. As a matter of fact, that was and is the central point and part of the gift question. At no time, she says, did the President instruct her to turn those gifts over. I think that is a telling point. In fact, that's a telling point throughout the entire process of the scheme and all the things that happen and why you have to follow, in my judgment, Senators, the issue of this whole process through the scheme that was devised at the beginning all the way to the end. The President was going to ultimately lie to conceal from that case, that court in the Jones case, the truth of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, and therefore he had to set it up for the affidavit, the gifts, etc. At no point in time, she says in her testimony, did he ever ask her to come clean at the time the affidavit was discussed on the night of December the 17th. He never suggested she tell the truth there. If you remember, we put that up here several times to you, even though he may not have directly told her to lie, he certainly gave her every indication, she said, from the standpoint of the background that they'd had before and what he said that night about the cover stories. And with regard to the gifts, same thing is true. She gave him an opportunity on the day of December 28th, and whether there are 10 statements or however many there might be, and they say there are 10, I trust the judgment of the White House counsel, there were 10 different statements, the most significant of which, of course, is the grand jury testimony she gave on the subject of what happened that day when she discussed the gifts with the President, because that's when her recollection had been best refreshed. She'd been over it a lot of times. She had much preparation for that. And I would submit to you that barring bringing her in here, which we'd, of course, suggest you do, and let us ask her to confirm all of this again, that you must assume, the logical thing to do is to assume that the grand jury testimony, the most perfected testimony you have, is the most accurate and most reliable. And in that occasion particularly, she emphasizes the fact that with regard to the gifts, there certainly was no request by the President that she reveal those gifts. Now, of course, he says he did. He says he did later. But that is absolutely contradicted by her testimony.
Senator Reid, I believe of Nevada, sends this question to the White House counsel. Would you please comment on any of the legal or factual assertions made by the managers in their response to the previous question?
There is obviously a conflict in the testimony between the President, who said he directed Ms. Lewinsky to turn over whatever she had, and Ms. Lewinsky's statements. I would just like to read to you, given the House manager's reference that we must credit her grand jury testimony, the version of her grand jury testimony, which you all will no doubt remember it as one of the ones I read to you that was never presented by the House managers. And that is, on August 20th, 1998, after the President had testified, it was December 28th. I was there to get my Christmas gifts from him, and we spent about 5 minutes or so, not very long, talking about the case. And I said, well, do you think? And at one point I said, well, do you think I should, and I don't think I said get rid of, But do you think I should put away or give to Betty or give to someone the gifts? And he, I don't remember his response. I think it was something like, I don't know, or hmm, or there was really no response. On that same day, when she was asked that same question, if it is her grand jury testimony that is to be addressed, she also said, a juror. Now, did you bring up Betty's name? Or did the president bring up Betty's name? The witness, I think I brought it up. The president wouldn't have brought up Betty's name because he didn't really discuss it. All of those are in her grand jury testimony. So her grand jury testimony is a testimony that states he might not have given any response. And so to the extent the House manager's theory is that let me think about it leads to obstruction of justice, her grand jury testimony does not state that.
Senators Helms, Abraham, Ashcroft, and Stevens, direct this question to the President's Inspector. Direct this question to the President's Counsel. President Clinton testified before the grand jury that he was merely trying to refresh his memory when he made these statements to Betty Curry. How can someone refresh their recollection by making statements they know are false?
I think as one of the things I tried to address in addressing what the president's testimony was with respect to his conversation with Ms. Curry was obviously he was understandably concerned about the media attention that he knew was impending. And in particular, as he walked through the questions, he was thinking about his own thoughts and seeking, as I think I talked about, concurrence or input or some type of reaction from Ms. Curry. I think in making those statements, he was asking statements to see what her understanding was based on some of the questions that had been posed to him by the Jones lawyers, because some of them were so off base. And so he was asking from Ms. Curry, essentially, what her perception was, what her thoughts were. And I think as you walk through each one of those questions, he was expressing what his own thoughts and feelings were with regard to this, and was seeking some concurrence or affirmation from her. I think he was agitated. I think he was concerned. He knew what was going to happen, and I think that is why he posed the questions in the way that he did.
Question from Senator Bayh to counsel for the president. Can you comment on the importance of proportionality to the rule of law?
How much time do we have? Thank you, Senator. I think proportionality in all its many guises is an issue that has given us some pause going well back into the investigative phase of this matter. And I think many who have watched and who've made their lives and their careers as professional prosecutors, and indeed many who have
Encore Book Notes.